Welcome back to SB3. I'm Al, and this is the show that blends space, sports, and spectroscopy, talking about the latest space and chemical research and the latest developments in the sports world. And it's the first episode of 2021. A new year, a new day, and what signals a new day? That's right, the sunrise. So today, let's continue discussing renewable energy, specifically solar power. At first glance, solar power seems like something we should be able to harness to use for our benefit. I mean, plants take in sunlight and are able to convert it to usable energy through photosynthesis. But it turns out that it's fairly difficult to convert sunlight to electricity. According to NASA, the total amount of solar irradiance is about 1,367 watts per square meter at the top of the atmosphere directly facing the sun. But given that only half of the planet is in daylight at a time, and that the planet is nearly spherical in shape, this means that on average across the entire planet, the planet receives about 340 watts per square meter at the top of the atmosphere. This is due to the maximum amount of energy being received when the sunlight is coming in at the perpendicular or normal angle. The bigger deviation from this normal, the less energy received. When the attenuation, or the loss of energy due to scattering and absorption by the atmosphere, is taken into account, a total of 164 watts per square meter reaches the surface. So that means across the entire Earth's surface, in one day, we receive 84 terawatts of power, and our average daily consumption is about 12 terawatts. So does this mean we're able to completely switch over to solar? Well, no. First of all, only 29% of the surface is covered in land, so that brings the amount of power received on land to almost 24.4 terawatts. Second, we don't want to cover every square inch of land with solar panels. There wouldn't be any room for parks, ball fields, streets, gardens, agriculture, etc. So when we have to be strategic with the placements of our solar panels. But it's also important to realize that not even solar panels have 100% efficiency, and therein lies the opportunity to carry out tremendous research into improving the efficiency of these panels. And there is tons of research to talk about. But first I want to describe how solar panels, or more officially known as photovoltaic modules, function. So if I use photovoltaic modules, PV modules, interchangeably with solar panels, know that I'm talking about the same thing. So PV modules are composed of individual PV or solar cells. So actually, that applies anytime I use the term PV or solar. I'll just use solar cells, solar panels, etc., just to keep it consistent. So where was I? Oh yeah, the basic solar cell. The typical solar cell has a number of different layers of materials that consist of the device. There's usually a metal contact as the contact point with the rest of the wiring. On top of the metal contact is the semiconductor wafer, and this semiconducting material is most often crystalline silicon utilized as a PN junction, and I'll get to this in a second. On top of the semiconductor is an anti-reflective coating with protective glass on top of that. The main driver that causes the solar cell to convert solar energy to electricity is that PN junction. In a single crystal of silicon, there is an interface where one part has an excess of holes, the P or positive side, and the other part has an excess of electrons, the N or negative side. These electrons are in the outer shells of the neutral atoms of the N side. This allows electrons to move in one direction through the semiconductor only. So how is this difference between areas in a single crystal formed? You might think it would be easier to just develop two different grains of material, one P grain and one N grain, and just fuse them together to create a PN junction. But that would actually hamper the cell's ability to convert energy by introducing a grain boundary between the semiconductors. So the better way is to create the PN junction directly in the same crystal. And there are several ways to do this, and they're all different types of doping. Most of the doping that occurs involves ion implantation, diffusion of dopants, or epitaxy. Ion implantation involves accelerating ions of a desired element into the silicon wafer target, and the ion staying in the crystal structure of the wafer. And after annealing, they can create charge carriers in the material. Elements like boron, aluminum, gallium, and indium are acceptors, or p-type dopants, meaning that they create holes. Elements like phosphorus, arsenic, antimony, bismuth, and even lithium are donors, or n-type dopants, meaning that electrons are created by implanting ions of these elements. Diffusion of dopants in semiconductors is pretty self-explanatory. Dopants will naturally diffuse into a silicon wafer given the right conditions. Epitaxy involves growing a layer of a crystal with one type of dopant on top of a layer of the crystal with the other type of dopant. Having the p-type and n-type form a junction in a semiconductor means that these doped areas are in close contact with each other, and when this happens, the electrons naturally diffuse from the n-type side to the p-type side of the junction and recombine with the holes present on the p-side. And as you may know, the movement of electrons is an electric current. Once this doped semiconductor is formed and wired into a solar cell, it's able to begin converting solar energy into usable electricity. But how does this happen? Well, usually, three different things can happen when a photon from the sun reaches a solar cell. First, it could pass straight through the cell, and this usually happens for very low energy photons, like radio waves. Solar cells are not able to pick up your favorite music over the air, despite them being technological marvels. Second, it could be reflected off of the cell, either by the glass, the wafer, or even the anti-reflective coating. Nothing is 100% effective, so even an anti-reflective coating could reflect some of the incoming photons. Third, it could be absorbed by the wafer, and that's where the magic happens. Once absorbed, the energy in the photon is transferred to the lattice structure of the crystal, where it excites an electron in the valence band to the conduction band. The valence band is basically the highest energy level the electrons are naturally at, where the conduction band is the lowest of the vacant electron levels. So once the electron is in the conduction band, it can move freely throughout the semiconductor, which leaves a hole in its wake. A neighboring electron rushes to fill that hole, which in turn creates another hole. This spreads holes out across the material. And again, the physical nature of the p-n junction forces the electrons to move in one direction only. So does this mean that all photons that are absorbed create an electric current? Well, no. In the case of solar cells, energy from the sun that is higher than the band gap between the valence and conduction bands are still absorbed, but the excess energy is converted to heat via lattice vibrations, and they're known as phonons, not photons. And once energy is converted to heat, it can't be converted into usable electrical energy, at least not with the technology we have now. So this describes the basic solar cell, albeit in very simple terms. I took a whole class about these kinds of semiconductors and devices where they're used in grad school while pursuing my PhD, so there is a ton more information regarding how these devices work, and I think they're out of scope for this 20-minute podcast. So if you have any particular questions regarding a specific aspect of how specific junctions work, or how the Fermi level governs electrical flow, or any other topic related to this, please reach out to the show and I'll get back to you. This solar cell is just the basic unit, just like how one cell is only part of the human body. A whole bunch of solar cells connected in series or in parallel forms a solar panel. Connections in series yield additive voltage, while connections in parallel yield higher currents. But those connections in parallel could result in solar panels being shut down due to panels that are shadowed, and this could cause significant power loss across the whole array. Having as much power available is what's really ideal for a whole array of solar panels. So when these panels are collecting energy from all of the individual cells effectively, they're converting solar energy into direct current, or DC power, and then an inverter converts the DC power into alternating current, or AC power, which is what the majority of electric is delivered as to homes and businesses, and what the majority of appliances use to function. Most of the electricity in our society is AC power. So it sounds like there's a lot of material needed to build these panels. I mean, you need good, strong, almost perfectly clear glass, an adequate anti-reflective coating, and a semiconducting silicon wafer doped with different elements, or even potentially a wafer that consists of something else other than silicon. So it has to be fairly expensive, right? And what we find is the exponential decline in cost for creating solar power. When this was first being implemented way back in the 70s, it cost about $76 per watt of energy. But this has been tremendously reduced down to about 30 cents in 2016, according to Bloomberg New Energy Finance. This solar power has been cheaper than the price for the same amount of energy derived from oil since 2004, and continues to fall in price as more and more of the market share of energy is taken by solar. And once the panels are installed on a home or business, any excess energy that the panels gather can be fed back into the system to reduce your energy bill even more. But let's compare solar power when compared with fossil fuels, because that would be the main goal, to replace fossil fuels as the main source of our energy. In terms of carbon dioxide emissions, solar produces about 90 grams of CO2 per kilowatt hour, where gas is at 543 and coal is at 1,004 grams of CO2 per kilowatt hour as of a 2008 study. And along with the price of solar power, carbon emissions are also trending way down when compared to coal and gas, which are both steady. In terms of water consumption, solar uses about 10 kilograms per kilowatt hour, where coal and gas are at about 78, nearly 8 times as much. The one drawback in solar comes from the efficiency of converting the solar energy into electrical energy. Of the commercially available solar panels as of 2020, the highest efficiency panels can convert at a maximum slightly over 22% of solar energy into electrical energy. This energy efficiency is pretty far below the maximum efficiency provided by gas at around 50%. But after this short break, let's talk about how the latest solar panels that are currently being researched and developed are improving the efficiency of how new materials are being developed into solar panels. So, talking about solar panel efficiency, the commercially available panels are at most 22% efficient at converting solar power to electrical power. But there are tons of other types of panels out there under research looking to achieve higher efficiencies. This is where different materials and different types of junctions come into play. And just for comparison, the most efficient crystalline silicon-based solar panel has been developed by Aminix in 2005 and utilizes a concentrator to reach about 27.6% efficiency. A concentrator is just a system that uses lenses or mirrors to focus sunlight onto the cell. Another type of solar cell utilizes materials completely different from silicon altogether. Known as SiGs cells, these are thin films of copper, indium, gallium, and selenium, deposited onto a glass or plastic backing. The plastic can even provide some flexibility to these thin film cells. These have been developed continuously by different entities since 1976, and have come a long way since their initial efficiencies of 5%. The current thin film SiG cells developed by Solar Frontier in 2019 have an efficiency of 23.4%. Not quite to the level of silicon-based cells, but there has been a steady incline in the performance of SiG cells. Silicon and SiG cells are pretty old technologies, though. both being under development since the 70s. So researchers have been experimenting with emerging materials to see if they have some viability as solar cells. Organic materials have shown some promise. The latest solely organic solar cell developed by two universities in China, developed in 2020, shows an efficiency of 18.2%. But inorganic cells remain as the most viable options to date. Another emerging material is perovskite. Perovskite is a calcium titanium oxide mineral that can be used as the active layer of the cell. On top of the perovskite material is usually a tin or lead halide based material that assists the material capture the photons to be converted into electricity. The most effective of these types of cells has been developed by UNIST, a university in Korea, and has reached an efficiency of 25.5%. But what about combining perovskite with something more established like SIGs, for example? Well, the most efficient of these tandem cells was developed by Helmholtz Zentrum Berlin, or HZB, in 2020, which has an efficiency of about 24.2%. In this cell, the SIGS layer is about 3 to 4 nanometers thick and absorbs infrared, while the perovskite is about half a nanometer thick and absorbs visible light. A thin layer of rubidium atoms were placed between these layers to improve the contact between them. It's a little surprising for me though. I thought that SIGs combined with perovskite would have a higher efficiency than that, but these have only begun to be researched, only being started in 2019. Most of the other types of cells have been researched for years before reaching their current max efficiencies, so I'm sure that these will be improved in the years to come. And one of the major benefits of making such efficient solar cells that are so thin is that these cells can be wired to form flexible solar panels. Making them flexible could help them be integrated into clothes so you could charge your phone while going for a walk outside, listening to this podcast, for example. They could also have more important uses as well, obviously. Like being able to charge astronauts' spacesuits while they complete spacewalks without having the need to either carry large bulky batteries or cutting tasks short in case the batteries on hand run out of juice. These flexible cells could also be integrated into 3D printed devices so that these devices could be preloaded with the necessary power supply. So of these different types of solar cells, crystalline silicon seems to be the best. But what about combining silicon with one of the emerging materials? A perovskite silicon tandem cell developed by Oxford clocks in at 29.5%. And now we're finally closing in on 30%. I know it doesn't sound great, but considering these started in the low single digits for efficiency, this has been tremendous progress. But there has to be some other way to combine different materials to reach even higher efficiencies. Now, researchers have developed multi-junction solar cells. These cells are basically just thin layers of different solar cells grown on top of each other through epitaxy. Some of these cells have 2, 3, 4, or even more junctions in one solar cell. And the way these multi-junctions function, that's a tongue twister, is that each successive layer has a different band gap energy, which allows it to absorb a different range of photons in the spectrum. So this means that these multi-junctions are able to absorb a wider range of photons simultaneously, giving the cell a chance to convert more photons to electricity. And the best of these multi-junction solar cells was developed by the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, or NREL, in 2020, with an efficiency of 47.1%, which is so incredibly high. It's a 6-junction solar cell where the layers are aluminum-gallium-indium-phosphide, aluminum-gallium-arsenide, gallium-arsenide, and 3 different structures of gallium-indium-arsenide. You got all that? In these In total, these six different structures are stacked on top of each other across 140 layers, and once all of these are stacked, this cell is thinner than the width of a human hair, which is only 75 microns. But one caveat to get to this level of efficiency, though. The light had to be focused to 143 times as intense as regular sunlight. Obviously, this is not what can happen in regular everyday use. Only low levels of focus can be done through lenses and mirrors. So in order to test this for more applicable uses, this exact cell showed about 39.2% efficiency at light with the same intensity as the sun, which is way more than all the other solar cells I've mentioned here. So this kind of six-layer cell seems like it could have some real potential to provide reliable and even cheaper renewable energy. And with the cost of solar being so low as is, and the added benefits of reducing the need for water, and the obvious huge reduction in CO2 emissions to produce the energy, solar should be further developed to increase the efficiencies and possibly be paired with wind as the main source for our power supply. And with that, thanks for listening to SP3. And please don't forget to listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and rate and review if you can. Also, if you would like to become a supporter of this podcast, please go to the show page on Anchor and click on support. I would really appreciate it. And if you want to reach out and leave a comment, ask a question, or give a suggestion, please feel free to email the show at spacesportsspectroscopy@gmail.com. And don't forget to follow the show on Facebook and Instagram. The show also has a brand new Twitter account, @SP3Podcast, which I try to be active on, so please give the show a follow on there too. Links to the socials and the research mentioned are in the episode description. Thanks. And I'm a big fan of the Beatles. I think their music is timeless. And I think solar panels like them as well. I heard that solar panels' favorite song is Here Comes the Sun.